Yeah, we're studying about King Asa in, well, now in 2 Chronicles. We looked previously at the verses in 1 Kings chapter 15. That was verses 8 through 24. So there were 17 verses in 1 Kings that covered the reign of King Asa, primarily focusing on the tie-in with him to Baasha, who was the king of Israel during that overlapped him primarily. But 2 Chronicles is where we have three chapters, chapters 14, 15, and 16, three chapters that cover the reign of King Asa of Judah. And what we've seen thus far, of course, is that Asa was one of these few kings in the land of Israel during the period of their having kings. He was one of the few that served the Lord and walked in the footsteps of David. His father had not, Abijam. His grandfather had forsaken the Lord after 3 years of serving him. That was Rehoboam. And then after him, well, his son is going to follow the Lord, Jehoshaphat. But really, when we say one of few, how few? Well, when we look at the northern kingdom, so the kingdom is split now after Solomon, and you ended up with 19 kings that were that from Jeroboam the son of Nebat through Hoshea. There were 19 kings that ruled over the northern kingdom of Israel. How many of those 19 were righteous? Well, who was the first one? Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. And what did he do? You know, he made Israel sin by coming up, making up a false religion for them to follow. And so the ones who were righteous in those of those tribes, they had to leave. And most of them, the ones who were there that did love the Lord, they left during right after the split of the kingdom and joined themselves to Judah, to Rehoboam, and strengthened his kingdom. We'd already seen that back in chapter 11. All the subsequent kings that were after Jeroboam in of the northern kingdom, even though they were rarely was, there were only a few kings that were of the same dynasty, that is the same family of those kings. Usually somebody would overthrow them and murder them and their family and then establish a new one. And so it's not that there were 19 that were all of descended from one family. But of those 19, how many were righteous? None of them. Because after Jeroboam, what happened? What does it say about all the rest of them? They departed not from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and made Israel to sin. We're going to see that statement over and over again. How many kings were there in Judah, beginning with Rehoboam? We're not including the three who were kings of all three of all 12 tribes. And how many kings reigned over all 12 tribes? There were only three: Saul, David, Solomon. But then after the split, how many, beginning with Rehoboam, how many kings were there of Judah? It's easy to remember. There were 19. Just like in the north, so there ended up being 19 of each. Now, it wasn't over the same period of time. The kingdom, the northern kingdom, fell to the Assyrians in 722 BC. The southern kingdom, Jerusalem, fell to the Babylonians in 586 BC. So there's that comes out to 136 years. From the fall of Israel, Samaria and Israel, to the fall of Jerusalem and Judah. So you had 136 more years where Judah was alone. So the 19, I mean, if you're gonna do an average length of reign, I mean, you're looking at a much larger period of time for Judah than for Israel. But it so happens that in spite of the difference in how many years each kingdom lasted, there were 19 kings of each. And we're not including Athaliah, who was made herself queen briefly in Judah. There were 19 kings in the southern kingdom. Well, and we're not going to include the ones who started off like Rehoboam had three good years and then departed from the Lord. So is he accounted as one who was righteous and walked in the ways of David? No, because he departed from the Lord and didn't repent. And that's why we read about how he did evil, because he prepared not his heart to seek the Lord. So we already saw that problem. There are going to be a few others that we're going to see, like Joash, who was instructed by a righteous high priest. He was the grandson of Athaliah. We'll get to all that later. I know we're just kind of reviewing a little bit, taking a kind of a survey of the big picture, the whole history there, just to for us to appreciate more what the time of Asa and then his son Jehoshaphat. This is a rare high point in Israel during the period of the kings. But at any rate, Joash, who was Athaliah's grandson, and Athaliah murdered her grandchildren so that she could be queen. Her son was killed by Jehu, and so she made herself queen, but the only way she was going to hold the throne would be if there were no other descendants of her son. So she killed her, murdered her own grandchildren, but one of them was saved and hidden by the high priest, Jehoiada, and his wife was the sister of, was the aunt of Joash, and so they were righteous, and they brought him up in the ways of the Lord, and he was made king when he was 7 years old, and Athaliah was killed then, but Jehoiada was there with him, instructing him, teaching him, and being an example of righteousness. And but as soon as Jehoiada died, what happened? Joash turned away from the Lord. So is he, in fact, then he ended up, the Lord sent a prophet that happened to be the son of Jehoiada, the high priest, which Joash was brought up in that family. So, I mean, he was his first cousin, but brought up like a brother. And what did he do with him when he came and this Zechariah, he was another Zechariah that was a prophet, not the one that bears the name of the book. Of Zechariah. But what did he do with him? He murdered him because he told him the truth and called him to repentance. So, I mean, do we call Joash, is he righteous just because he had a few good years when he was doing what his uncle, a righteous high priest, had instructed him to do? As soon as he was on his own, he departed. So no, he was not a righteous man. And so we're not going to count those ones who may have started off doing some things that were right, but then forsook the Lord. And that's really a point of where we are in 2 Chronicles chapter 15 with this prophet that came to Asa at this time, speaking about seeking the Lord and not forsaking him. So when we only count the ones who should be counted as righteous, as the Lord judges that, those who served him and did not depart from him and forsake him. I mean, how many of the 19 of Judah were there? Four. This is the first one. And the second one's going to be his son, Jehoshaphat. So you got Asa, Jehoshaphat, then later we're going to have Hezekiah, and then after that, Josiah. That's it. So when you take 30, so you combine that, 38 kings after Solomon of the divided kingdom, there's 38 combined, the northern and southern kingdoms. And of 38 kings, how many were righteous? Four. Four out of 38. And even if you want to include Saul, David, and Solomon, when Israel got a king, when they demanded to have a king, the Lord had chosen the system of judges for them. So including the first three that reigned over all Israel, so there was a grand total of 41 kings in the entire period of the kings. And how many of those were righteous? That gives us 6 out of 41. Does that sound like a good percentage? That's terrible. For the leader of Israel, of their nation, that's... But what did the Lord warn them when they demanded a king? I mean, is there any guarantee when you have a king that whoever's going to be king is going to be righteous? The choice of who's going to become king is not based in that. It's based in who was the heir to the throne of their father. That doesn't mean have anything to do with what kind of heart they have. Or in the case of the northern kingdom, whichever one could murder well enough to get to be king until somebody murdered him or his family. But it's not based in righteousness. But the system they had before with the judges, how many of the judges were wicked? Zero. So what percentage of the ones that God chose to be leaders for Israel under the system of judges were righteous? 100%. That's whom God chose for that reason. That's the reason that we had the book of Judges and those ones that we read about there. I mean, starting with Moses is the first judge, and Joshua, and then from there on, all the way to Samuel. I mean, those were all righteous servants of the Lord. They're included in that great cloud of witnesses in Hebrews chapter 11. When God was had the system He designed, how often did it fail? Never, of course. That system was designed to give Israel the very best. And that's why it didn't matter what tribe they were from. God would choose the best at whatever time it was and give them the very best leader for the nation. So that was always for their spiritual good. So then when they wanted to be like the nations around them, well, that's what happened, isn't it? And they certainly became like the nations around them. And they had wicked leaders for the most part. I mean, there was only... So that what comes out roughly 15% of all the kings that reigned when Israel had kings that were righteous. I mean, 85% were wicked. Whereas 100% of the judges were righteous. God's way or man's way? And that's a very clear example of it. So when we're reading about Asa and keeping that in mind, it really should help us to appreciate even more what we're reading about here with one of these rare righteous ones. And as we've already seen, given what his father had done and his grandfather before him, it's quite remarkable that just on the surface to see someone as dedicated to seeking God and doing His will as Asa was. And then we'll see that his son also walked in the ways of David. Now we're going to read about that didn't mean that they did not have their shortcomings along the way. We're going to read about one of Asa's in the next chapter, chapter 16, and he showed a stubbornness when he had some disease in his feet later in his life. But and of course, his son Jehoshaphat walked in the ways of David, but he committed a great error when he married his son into the house of Ahab. And that had great repercussions, bad ones for his family and for the kingdom that he reigned over. So we'll see the shortcomings that they had, but the Lord worked with them, sent his prophets to them, and they were ones who were steadfast in following the Lord. And when they fell short, they turned back to the Lord and did His will. They did not forsake Him. So back to chapter 15 then. In chapter 14, when Asa began his reign, what was one of the things, most noteworthy things about his early reign? Well, he was given 10 years of rest from their enemies, and God was the one that gave that period of rest because of the fact that Asa did what was right in his sight. So God rewarded him and blessed him for that. And Asa acknowledged that it was from God and it was because they were walking after his ways. And so he commanded his people to continue to do so. And then when they had an enemy, a great and powerful enemy, come against them with from Ethiopia, his faith did not waver. He continued to trust in the Lord and encouraged his subjects to do the same. And they relied upon the Lord in that, and God delivered them. So after that, I mean, Asa won a great victory at that time. So by being steadfast, God continued to bless him. But now at this time when things had been going so well, and we saw that this was a bit unusual, that God sent a prophet at that time. Usually the prophets would be sent by the Lord to his people when they had forsaken him, when he was calling them back to calling them to repentance, to return to him. This was a bit different, because God sent a prophet when things were actually going well. But we can understand why this exception occurs when we understand, going back to what we were just reviewing a bit ago with the spiritual climate that was in Israel during the period of the kings, and immediately during in Asa's own background, and what was going on with their neighbor to the north, which is brought up by this prophet here that comes to them. We can understand, but the pull would have been very strong to turn away from God. Well, Rehoboam had done that after 3 good years. He forsook the Lord. Well, God is sending this prophet to encourage them to continue on in spite of all the pressures that would be there to depart from him. We should appreciate that also. I mean, the time that we live in, just looking at what's going on in our society, our culture, and our country, and the world at large, is what's going on, the climate out there, spiritually speaking, is it making it easier for us or more difficult for us to continue to do the Lord's will? Or no difference compared to it just a few years ago? Yeah, we all know it's becoming more and more difficult. There's more and more pressure to conform to this world. And the more that we stay true to what God teaches, the more the persecution is growing and the pressure to forsake that. So we can understand in what we're going through now why it's very helpful to receive the encouragement from the Word of God when things like that are going on. Don't listen to this world. Don't give in to its pressures. Don't hear the wisdom of men. Continue to listen to God. Continue to follow in His ways, no matter what the world is doing. God's truth doesn't change, and we have to be steadfast and unmovable in that. Well, it's encouraging for us to read those words in these times, isn't it? So for God to send a prophet with words like that, then we should be able to understand how that would have been very encouraging to them in that situation. And we'll see the results of it that happens after this prophet has spoken to them. And this is the prophet Azariah, the son of Oded. And we've read the words, but let's go back and read 1 through 7 just to get all the words together. Briefly, we can review where we were and then hone in on the real key point of the message. But there's a background given, some history given just in these 7 verses. He's going to establish some unchanging principles that God operates by, and then he's going to give some contemporary and remote examples of those principles in action. And then based on all that, he's going to hit at verse 7 what the bottom line is and the purpose of his being sent by the Lord to Asa and the people of Judah this time. So let's just read those first 7 verses again. Let's see, Brother Stephen, can you read that for us? And this is chapter 15, 2 Chronicles 15, 1 to 7.
And the Spirit of God came upon Azariah, the son of Oded. And he went out to meet Asa and said unto him, "Fear ye me, Asa and all Judah and Benjamin. The Lord is with you, while ye be with him. Seek him,
right, so in verse 2, he began with reminding them of these, well, really, there are three related principles. They all function together there. In verse 2, the Lord is with you while you be with Him. That is a absolute true principle that God operated by, and not just in the Old Testament. This is God, and He doesn't change. I mean, what does James 4:8 say in the New Testament? Draw nigh to God, and He will draw nigh to you. I mean, that hasn't changed. As long as we're with the Lord, He's with us. And then number two, if you seek Him, He'll be found of you. What does Matthew 7:7-8 say? Sermon on the Mount. Yeah. Seek and you will find. Ask will be given to you. Knock and it will be opened unto you. I mean, that's still true. And then if you forsake Him, He'll forsake you. Now, if we don't, Hebrews 13:6 tells us is that I will never leave you nor forsake you. And as long as we don't forsake Him, but the counterpart to that or the reverse of that, as long as we draw near to God, He'll draw near to us and He'll never leave us nor forsake us. But if we do depart from Him and we forsake Him, He will forsake us. So He starts with those bedrock truths right there. God operates by those principles. So as long as we recognize that, as long as we draw near to Him, seek Him, and never forsake Him, He's never going to forsake us, and He's always going to be with us. That's as true today as it was when Azariah spoke those words to Asa and the people of Judah and Benjamin. So then, having reminded them of those truths, He gives some examples. Well, He gives the contemporary, the recent, the immediate example of what was going on just to their north with that kingdom, the northern kingdom of Israel. They had forsaken the Lord. They no longer were with walking with the Lord, and so the Lord had forsaken them. But it was because they departed from God, and for that long season, I mean, going back to the beginning, since the kingdom split with Jeroboam, all the way up to this present time, under Asa's reign, this entire history, in the course of that long season, would become a longer season, all the way to the end, until God put them out of existence. But they had been without the true God, and without a teaching priest, and without law. That's not because the true God disappeared, went out of existence. It's not because there were no teaching priests anywhere. And it was not because God's law disappeared, vanished, or somehow became invalid. The true God was still there. He had His teaching priests. His law was still in effect. So how did they become without all that? Because they rejected it. They decided to go another way. That's the very definition of heresy. A choice, an alternative to what God had said and established. So the moment they withdrew their steps from the paths of righteousness, and they got onto the broad road that leads to destruction, you change anything. And we made the point last week. It wasn't that they rejected all religion and became atheists. They were still religious. They still worshipped. They practiced religion. But it was falsehood. And when you follow something different than what God has established, which is His unchanging truth, then you're following false religion. And when you're following false religion, you are now without the true God. And you are now without His law because you've rejected Him and His word. So that's a plain statement of what the status of everyone is when they do not follow what God has commanded. And if we ever depart from Him, that will be true of us too. We compared that last week to Galatians chapter 1, what he wrote to the churches of Galatia there in Galatians 1 and verse 6. When he said, I marvel that you are so soon removed from Him that hath called you unto another gospel, which is not another, he goes on to say. And then verses 8 and 9 gave that curse twice to anyone whether man or angel, that teaches anything different than that gospel which they had heard preached to them, which is the true gospel. So any departure from Christ's gospel, if we do something, whatever it is, in our practice of religion, if we're doing something that is not taught and authorized by the very gospel of Christ, by the New Testament, then what are we? What have we done? That's why he said, I marvel that you're... He didn't just say so soon removed from that gospel. He said removed from him who has called you unto... And because they had now followed another gospel, which is not another. There's no... It's the same point. There's only one true God. He only had... There's one true Son of God. And there is one Lord, one faith, one baptism. We can go to Ephesians 4, 4 through 6 and see all the ones that are there again. The seven ones in those three verses. There's one of all of that, one true. And if you depart from that, what is true, you're now without it. And so when they departed from the Lord's gospel, they had departed from Christ. So there's no difference in the language of the principle taught there in Galatians 1 regarding what happens under the New Testament, the law of Christ, when someone departs from it in any way, versus what we're reading here in 2 Chronicles chapter 15 regarding the ones who departed from what God said under the old covenant. Whatever covenant God had in force for his people at that time being the old covenant, now the everlasting New Testament, departing from God's truth is departing from him. And so that's the example he gives of that they had right before them, which again is a reason why God sent this prophet. That's what was going on right around them. Look to your north. See what they've been doing. See what they've been doing for all these years since they've been their own kingdom. They have not been following the Lord. They have not been seeking him. They have forsaken him. So that means he's forsaken them. Well, then he moves on from there after verse 3 and actually is going back to what we would recognize from all the way back to the entire history of the nation of Israel. We saw it over and over, we see it over and over again, that cycle in the 400 plus years of the judges. Well, when they had the judge, as we mentioned, they were always righteous, ones that God had chosen for them. But the people would follow the Lord during the days of those judges. And then when that judge died, then what was the pattern? Well, here's another generation that has come along. And what do? Yeah. They would have to go try out the world and... they would forsake him. So going back to those principles that Azariah was established in their verse 2, reminding them of when they did what the northern kingdom of Israel had done. Same problem. But what happened, what we would see is after a time when they would be delivered into the hands of their enemies who would oppress them, then God would bring them to repentance. And then when they repented, what would happen? What would God do to their enemies when he would raise up another judge? And so that's what he was reminding them of. So here, look at what's going on in Israel. They've departed from the Lord. But also remember what happened in time past when people departed from the Lord and then they repented and returned to him. That God was merciful to them. That God received them back. So it all ties into those principles of verse 2 that God operates by. So reminding them of all of that, their immediate, what's going on around them and their, those recent times. And then also going back throughout their history, examples that, follow those, principles in verse 2. So what's the point then? Why does he remind them of the fact that the Lord is with them while they are with him, and that if they seek that they will find, and if they forsake the Lord, he'll forsake them. But then again, having repented, because what had been going on in Judah right before Asa had become king? under Abijah and under Rehoboam, after the three good years, what had happened? They had forsaken him. So had they now, under Asa, returned to following the Lord? Well, what did Asa do? He was getting rid of all of those idols that had been in the land. He drove the Sodomites out of the land that had come up there. He's going to remind and mention again in just a few verses down from here what we read earlier in the account in 1 Kings chapter 15, what he did with his own mother when she had a worship idol. So he removed her from being king, a queen. So did Israel... Had Judah departed from the Lord in recent times, right before Asa? Yeah, so here's that encouragement. Okay, you've done this yourselves, and like your predecessors and of your brethren in the history of Israel who had forsaken God and then repented and come back, and the Lord received them back. So now here's where you are right now. So in spite of all that, here they are under Asa, and they've been following the Lord for these years, and God has been blessing them. So based on those things he reminded them of in verse 2 and in this history, verse 7 gets to the point. Be strong, therefore, and let not your hands be weak, for your work will be rewarded. So continue to draw near to God. Continue to seek Him. Seek Him even more. And don't forsake Him. And what you do, God is going to bless. Brother Michael?
He's alluding to that this is a process. I mean, just like the backsliding. Process.
Yes.
The country doesn't immediately just turn to wickedness. It just slowly comes in, sometimes faster than others. But it's a process to turn back to the Lord. Asa is starting to follow, or he has followed the Lord. He's purging out all these things out of the kingdom. And now they're going to have to continue to grow in strength.
And that's an excellent point. It does remind us of what Jesus said in Matthew 24 when he said, when iniquity abounds, the love of many shall wax cold, grow cold. I mean, it doesn't happen overnight. There is a process to things. And whether it's the wrong direction, and iniquity had been abounding around them and within them, and their love had grown cold, but now they've turned back to him. But turning back to the Lord did not make them fully grown spiritually and to full strength overnight. And so they had been following him now for these years under Asa, but they needed to do more, and they're going to. We'll see the result of this. They hadn't done it. They had done a lot of right things, and so had Asa. But he's going to do even more after this prophet comes to him. And so this is going to give them great encouragement, not just to be seeking God as much as they have, but to seek Him even more. Because this gets down to what the great commandment is. Had they been loving God and seeking God during these recent years under Asa? Yes. What's the great commandment of the law? All of your heart and soul and mind and strength. Have they reached that point? Had they grown in their love for God, that they were at this point, that they loved Him with all of their heart, soul, mind, and strength? Were they seeking Him with all of their heart, soul, mind, and strength? Not yet. They had been doing well, but they needed to do more. And so that's the point of this. And it's interesting because, here they are in where they're going to be. They've got difficult circumstances around them spiritually, as we mentioned, and there's a lot of pull to go into the world and a lot of pressure to not follow God. There was the second judge of Israel, whose name was Joshua the son of Nun. When he became the judge of Israel and their leader after the death of Moses, they were getting ready to go into the land of Canaan, a land full of wickedness. Nations that the Lord had warned them of about their wickedness, and it said, don't go, don't learn their ways. They were going to have difficulties. They were going to have to fight these people. Was that really going to be their main difficulty, the physical effort of engaging in warfare with all of those people of the land of Canaan? In actuality, no. Because, like we saw in the previous chapter here in 2 Chronicles 14, when the Ethiopians came, what was that truth that Asa recognized? did the numbers matter, how many soldiers they had or how strong they were? And one of the great battles that we remember from the history of the Judges under Joshua, Joshua chapter 10, when you had five kings of the Amorites that banded themselves together to come against them, and what ended up happening? Well, that was when it was five of those kings, Joshua and the Israelites fought them, and they prevailed. But what did God end up doing that day? Well, He did a couple things. He sent hailstones down on them when they were fleeing from the Israelites, and it says that He killed more of them with His hailstones than the Israelites killed with their swords. Then God made the sun and moon stand still in the sky that day to prolong the light that they would have to prevent the ones who were surviving and trying to run and hide, and they were obviously hoping for the cover of darkness so that they could escape. But God extended that daylight, making the sun and moon stand still so that darkness wasn't going to save them. Look at the actions that God took there. So, I mean, was it the physical effort it was going to take? No. And we have examples, numerous examples where, I mean, Israel, they didn't have to even lift a sword in battle. I mean, this was the battle was the Lord's. So as far as the physical part of it, or the destroying of the enemies and conquering the land, I mean, that was, you know, of course, God did require effort on their part, but He was the one doing that. As long as they were following Him, I mean, look at the walls of Jericho. How did they have to really go through all of, they really have to strain their muscles trying to take down those giant walls piece stone by stone? They didn't do a thing to get those walls down. God made the walls fall flat when they did exactly what He told them to do. But we have so many examples of that. So when Josh is about to cross into Canaan, is the real problem, the real threat, the physical part of it, or the nature of their enemy? Well, in fact, Joshua, long before that, 40 years before that time, when he was a younger man and went into Canaan with Caleb and the 10 other spies, and they went into the land and they saw the big walled cities like Jericho, and they saw the giants that were in the land in that time, and how numerous they were and all of that. And when Joshua and Caleb came back, what were they? Were they saying, uh-oh? I mean, were they intimidated by any of that? Were they thinking, well, this is going to be a real hard job for us? Or do they recognize God's going to be, He's the one that's promised this. He'll take care of them. No problem. The other 10 were the problem because they didn't believe. Joshua and Caleb already understood that. So Joshua hasn't changed by the time, even though 40 years have gone by, and they're crossing the River Jordan there. The problem wasn't the physical aspect of that, or how many of there were, or the battles they were going to fight, and any of that stuff. What was the real threat to them that God really warned them about? I mean, how many times did God warn them about, beware of the height of these people, they're giants, or beware of their weapons? I mean, they got some pretty good chariots, they got some pretty good swords and spears and arrows, and they got some real good marksmen. How many times do we see the Lord warning them about the skill, the size, and the number of their enemies, or the strength of the city? Be careful about these walls over here. They're going to be real tough for you. I mean, how many times do we ever read God warning them about that? That aspect? Never. What did God warn them about? Over and over again. These people are wicked. Don't learn their ways. Don't follow their ways. That was the threat to them, the spiritual threat. So when they were about to enter the land, and this is much like what they were about to enter into a climate, what Asa was in at this time. One reason why the words are so similar. What did the Lord say to Joshua at that time he was about to lead them across into the Jordan River, into that endeavor? In Joshua chapter 1 and verse 7. Hint. We sing a song about this. Or of these very words. Let's read Joshua chapter 1 and verse 7. And note the similarity of what the Lord said to Joshua at that time with what the Lord is saying to Asa at this time. Let's see, Brother Dave, can you read that for us, please? Joshua 1 and verse 7.
Be thou strong and very courageous, that thou mayest observe to do according to all the law, which Moses
how similar are those words to 2 Chronicles chapter 15 and verse 7? Be strong, therefore, and let not your hands be weak, for your work shall be rewarded. It's the same thing, same message. I mean, he's telling them to be strong and courageous. Don't depart from at all from what God has said. Keep his commandments. As long as you're with him, he'll be with you. As long as you seek him, he'll be found of you. If you forsake him, he'll forsake you. Don't do that. Be strong. Don't let yourselves get weak. Continue to seek God and serve him with all your heart. And then he's going to bless what you do. So he's putting their attention on the thing that really does matter. The one and only thing that really does matter. Whether they are seeking and serving their Maker or not. That's what he encouraged Joshua with. That's what he's encouraging these people with. What he's encouraging us with. So in this difficult times we live in, that's the same message for us. Is we need to be strong and courageous. And we better not let our hands get weak. We better not let ourselves become discouraged. Don't let the abounding iniquity in this world cause our love for God to get weak and cool in any fashion. But stay steadfast and unmovable. Continue to keep all of his commandments and not depart from any one of them to the right hand or to the left, no matter how much persecution we're going to face because of it. I mean, that's why we're studying this. And this is what God was encouraging them in. Well, when Asa heard these words, did it make a difference to him? It gave him great encouragement. It inspired him to be even more zealous in doing the Lord's will. Let's see the immediate results from this in verses 8. Well, we'll go down to verse 14, 8 through 14. Let's read that, Brother Glenn.
And when Esther heard these words and the prophecy of the prophet, he took courage and put away the armor of Isaiah, out of all the land of Judah and Benjamin, and out of the cities which he had taken from Mount Ephraim, and renewed the offer of the Lord that was before the porch of the Lord. And he gathered all Judah and Benjamin and the strangers with him out of Ephraim and Manasseh.
So we can see the encouragement that Asa received from the words of that prophet the Lord sent, which was the whole purpose behind that. Well, he had already, when he became king, had been removing idols, but he went and found some more, didn't he? He found some more and got rid of those. Not only that, the verses that are in 1 Kings chapter 15 about King Asa, mainly tying into what was going on between him and Baasha. Well, what had gone on there? Remember, Baasha had come down and strengthened, built strong cities in the south on that border with Benjamin to try to block Judah from being able to invade at any point in the future, and then that failed, and so Asa ended up taking those strong points from Baasha, thank you very much for all the materials and the extra strength for those places that that Baasha gave to Asa. So his efforts there actually ended up helping his enemy. But Asa took cities and strongholds from from Israel. Well, what did he do with those places? What does it tell us there in verse 8 that he did? He didn't just take, remove the idols out of the land of Judah and Benjamin, which is his kingdom. But what else? Yeah, those cities as well. So he's cleaning up whatever he's got control over. So he's... and then furthermore, he renewed the altar of the Lord that was before the porch of the Lord. So he's renovating, he's making things better for them to be able to serve the Lord. And then it tells us, verse 9, this had ripple effects. So those ones that were in the northern kingdom, well, back in Rehoboam's time, we already know about the ones that were serving the Lord there at that time. They left and they joined themselves and strengthened Rehoboam and his kingdom when they came down to Judah. But they left because they couldn't serve the Lord properly there. Well, now the ones that are there in the northern kingdom, I mean, they're seeing what God is doing and blessing Asa, and they're seeing how Asa is serving God and how his people are and how God is blessing them, and they're even taking some of the cities from that northern kingdom, and he's cleaning them up and getting the idols out of those places. Did that have any effect on any of the people up there? There were some more. You could ask the question, well, why they waited so long? Well, they needed a little more. So what God was doing here was not just for Asa, and it was not just for the people of Judah and Benjamin. God's working with all of his people, and even those ones in the north. So there's some that had, there was something there in some of them still as far as a love for God, but they had, it had obviously been weakened significantly with all the evil going on in their kingdom. And, well, is it a big decision to say, well, I'm going to leave my inheritance, my land, and I'm going to leave all of my people, my place, everything, never go back to go to this other place so I can serve the Lord? That takes some faith, and it takes some strength. Were there some that recognize that's what they should do, but they just had not gotten to the point where they said, okay, I've got to do it, I'm going to do it. Well, there's obviously so, because this situation now pushes several of them. We see their number, there's still some more that were up there. But these events inspire and encourage them also. And then they come out of these places from Ephraim and Manasseh and Simeon and came to him in abundance when they saw the Lord God was with him. So this, what Asa is doing and the positive impact that's having on his people is now reverberating, and the ripple effect is going and affecting in a positive way even people up in the other kingdom now, God's other people. Anything to be learned from that? If we are steadfast and we're unmovable and we serve God with all of our might, can God use what we're doing to encourage other people? See, we're not just out here by ourselves. Did he know that was going to happen? Did Asa know that when he was doing all these things that people from the other kingdom were going to turn back to God fully and they were going to abundantly, a lot of them were going to come down and join with him? Did he know that? How could he have known that? But that's what happened. So when he's doing right, God used that in ways that he didn't even see or couldn't have known. Well, how much can we see, or how much can we know of how God can use whatever we're doing if we'll do what he tells us to do and the ways that he can use that, and how many other people that he can encourage, and how many people can see us shine as lights in this world, and might he use that to turn people to him? We don't know, but there's an example right there. And we know that God can do very great things. So if we will do our part, we can leave that up to the Lord, how he's going to work that out in all the ways that he can do good with that. So that's a very encouraging example that we see right there. So then they all came down there, and this is in his 15th year, and they're making offerings to the Lord, and then they enter into a covenant, and they swear that they're going to seek him with all their heart and not depart from him, going back to those initial words of that prophet. And so, yeah, if you are with the Lord, he'll be with you, And he won't forsake you if you don't forsake him. And if you seek him, you'll find. So Asa makes them swear that that's what they're going to do. And they do that. Now, at the beginning of our time, Lord willing, next week, we want to contrast that with what's going to happen on down the line with a... there are two other kings. We mentioned that there were four righteous ones in Judah. Well, here's one of the four. Well, Jehoshaphat doesn't have to do something like what Asa did because his Jehoshaphat's father is Asa. So Asa's already taken care of this, getting the people turning back to the Lord and following him. Jehoshaphat's job is to continue that, which he does. But there are going to be two other kings that are going to come to reign over Judah when things have been going very poorly before them, and that will be Hezekiah and Josiah. And both of them are going to do exactly what Asa did in this case, making the people enter into this oath to follow the Lord. And but we want to make some comparisons to what happens in those other two cases like this. That in this case, and the people are going to rejoice in doing that, the people are with them. And so God is able to work that for all of them. And the same thing happens under Hezekiah, but not Josiah. Josiah makes them swear. But at that point, the people are not sincere. And they do it because they're made to do it, but they don't really believe it. And we'll see that. And there are lessons to be learned from that too. But Lord willing, we'll continue with this study next time.